Hello, I'm Damien Coleridge, the producer and presenter of this week's Encounter. I've called it Lost Souls. It's about pornography, sexuality, and meaning.
I mean, you've got a terrible problem with pornography. I've got no problem. I love it.
Beatrice Faust is right. I do have a problem with pornography. I certainly don't love it. But I'm interested in what it means. Child pornography? Or non-violent erotica? Or violent erotica? Or what? What do we mean by pornography? And where are we with regard to pornography at present? Didn't we decide in the 70s that it was a bit tacky but okay for it to be available for those who wanted it? Why bother? So, what we got in the 80s, as someone from the St. James Ethics Centre said recently, was an abandonment of conscience to regulation. We've moved on from the 80s. A 1993 paperback, Pornography, Women, Violence and Civil Liberties, edited by Catherine Itzen, suggests that it's time to reconsider our notions about pornography. We've had 20 years of it in public, and we now know a lot more about its impact on our lives. And the whole business of pornography raises wider questions about sex, meaning, and identity. Pretty basic stuff. You say that pornography plays a part in every stage in the cycle of sexual abuse.
That's correct. In the sense, in the book, I will talk about predisposition because I think there are cases, and I have clear cases where I believe there is quite a link between some men actually taking part in something pornographic and then going and acting it out. But I accept the fact that in a logical clinical debate, one could still say that person was going to abuse anyway and that the pornography was only part of it. And that's why I would never usually get into an argument about that. I would say let's not even bother to get into a causal link argument, but let's just look at how in general pornography maintains the distorted thinking of abusers, how at the least it makes sexism sexy, and how at one level it is about exploitation and about abuse, and in a sense that's somehow separate to many of the feminist arguments themselves that they have about pornography, about the way the women are seen, used and exploited. I've always been interested in where misogyny comes from in our society, why men do link abuse and anger and revenge to sexual behaviour. I'm interested in all of those things, and I think, therefore, it is right to consider debating the issue about the role of pornography in offending.
Ray Wire. He's the principal advisor to the Faithful Foundation. It's named after Baroness Faithful, in England. For 20 years, he's been working with sex offenders and with abused women and children. He's contributed an essay to the book, Pornography, Women, Violence and Civil Liberties.
I think there are two very distinct things, and I think it's characteristic of our society that we collapse the two into one. One thing is a question, which is a cultural, philosophical, social question, which is pornography harmful? Even is pornography wicked? And I think that can be looked at in a non-political way, as an issue in which Quadrant has been debating for 2 years now, with many different points of view. The second question is the political question. If you decide that it is dangerous, harmful, wicked, what do you do about it? And that's a question for the society at large and for democratic politics. But I think you can certainly debate the issue without immediately turning it into the question of censorship and regulation. The more interesting and reflective question is whether it's harmful to our deeper being, to our spiritual existence, to our moral existence, to the kind of society we are. And in a way, that's the first and most important debate to have. The second debate, which is also important, is if we come to a certain consensus about a very dangerous direction we might have drifted in, what then do we do? But I think it's important not to collapse the moral into the political, as happens too quickly, too often.
Robert Mann. He's the editor of Quadrant. It's a conservative monthly, but its previous editor, Peter Coleman, was opposed to censorship in the 1950s and 1960s. Like others opposed to censorship, Coleman has more recently said that he didn't mean by this a yes to pornography.
So one of the things I wanted to do in the piece was to try to recast the sort of conceptual framework within which we might think about a lot of these sorts of issues. And in particular, I wanted to, and I don't think it was just a perverse thought, I wanted to suggest that at the end, both a certain kind of moralism and pornography attack a certain conception of the meaning of sexuality. And so I sometimes think that people who talk about wholesome values, or who might at any rate be attracted rather uncritically to talk of wholesome values, might in fact be closer to the pornographers in their attack on sexuality than they think.
Raymond Gaiter, Foundation Professor of Philosophy in the Institute of Advanced Research at the Australian Catholic University. His piece in the April issue of Quadrant is entitled Morality and Meaning, Reflections on the Pornography Debate. Here's how Beatrice Faust, she's the author of Women, Sex and Pornography, would recast the framework.
Well, I'd like to recast it by a recognition of male sexuality, that men are visually aroused and men are psychogenically aroused and men think more about sex than women do. And if we can accept that, then we can say, what is the basic function? Why is it that men are using pornography and on the whole, women aren't?
Raymond Gaiter made the point previously that the moralisers and the supporters of pornography often stand on common ground. That's the case, I think, in Beatrice Faust's criticism of the book Pornography, Women, Violence and Civil Liberties.
Yes, it's a politically correct book and it represents the extreme of feminist illiberalism.
I put that to Ray Wire, who's in the book.
I'm not exactly sure what those words mean. I mean, all I know is that having worked with sex offenders for many years, I was asked to contribute to a debate about the role of pornography in relationship to abuse.
I don't want to polarise the debate because that won't help any of us much to deal with these complex, fundamental issues.
You would say that pornography does have a social use.
Oh, it's got dozens of social uses. Every time I talk to men who use pornography, I discover new uses.
So in what ways can pornography be useful? A couple of ways.
Well, the most recent one I heard was that for men who despair of ever finding women who enjoy sex, it reminds them that somewhere in the world there are women who enjoy sex. And of course, feminists would say that those women aren't enjoying it. It's all a put-on. The man I met before that, who volunteered his life story to me, was severely handicapped in a number of ways. He's deaf, he communicates with prostitutes by writing, and he's got a whole box of his notes where he communicates his wishes to prostitutes, and he uses pornography as well. And for him, it is a tolerable way of enduring his handicaps. See, he's a sexually intact adult male with severe physical handicaps. Other uses quite simply are it expedites masturbation or it expedites sexual arousal, and it can confirm manhood, as with Dahmer. It confirmed for him there are other homosexuals. A lot of people go to pornography to see if they're normal. You know, are my genitals the same as everyone's, or at least not too different?
A lot of people don't go to pornography, though. They go altogether elsewhere.
Yes, but some people are embarrassed. You know, some people would be embarrassed to ask another man or another woman, are they normal? And a lot of women would pretend they wouldn't know what normal was because they've only seen one. So, you know, the communication about sex and your sexual performance and identity is not easy. And pornography, in its own limited way, fills in some of those gaps.
Is it also true to say that pornography may not be useful?
Yes, I feel that it is unfortunate that a lot of men believe that the women in pornography are typical women, because a lot of women are not easily aroused, they don't easily have sex, they don't enjoy athletics, and they may get a bad idea from it. However, one of the leading American blue film actors said he gave up acting in films because women expected too much of him. They'd say, oh, but look, you went 5 times in Blue Velvet. And he'd say, yes, that film took 10 days to make. So men can have false expectations of women. Women can have false expectations of men. The difficulty is that a lot of people use it as sex education. It only has very limited value as sex education.
Somebody might say, of course, you're working at the dramatic end of the spectrum, that there's a whole range of other possibilities in the use of pornography, some which may well be therapeutic.
Well, I disagree. Again, we'd have to start looking at what we mean by the definitions of pornography. But what's been interesting in this country is that 10 years ago, when one looks at the letters requesting pornography, there has been a major change. Now, about 63 to 67% of letters going to pornographers are actually asking for sadomasochism and much more violence within the pornography. That's been a major change. And regrettably, what we found in adult pornography that concerned animals and bondage and everything else is now being discovered in child pornography, whereas once it was not there. And I'm saying that should we take the risk? I accept that if we looked at a continuum, at one end there's a group of people who, it doesn't matter what you censor, they are still going to abuse. There's another end of the continuum, it doesn't matter sort of how liberal the pornography laws were, they would not abuse. But there's a group in the middle, and surely as a society we'd rather shift them into a non-abusive attitude than into the possibility of abusive attitudes. And I think that that's just talking about the offender. That's leaving out what women are saying in the main about pornography and about the exploitation and about, this is about providing for a male industry, a male-dominated industry, and finances involved. And I do not believe that the interests and the welfare of the women and the children are actually at the forefront of the pornography makers. I believe we're talking about commercial ends, and we're talking about exploitation. And I think the issue about men and the way pornography portrays men is an interesting debate as well. It prescribes my sexuality. It prescribes what I should want and how I should be. And I also resent the way the industry vilifies those people who want to stand out against it.
Could you conceive of pornography, as some people have spoken of it, as being of therapeutic use, of being of some use to someone?
Well, I mean, obviously it can be of use in getting people to have erections if they feel that they're impotent. I suppose that's a limited therapeutic use. But I think I'd make a general point about this, and it actually connects with another aspect of the pornography debate. A lot of people have claimed that pornography is, as it were, therapeutically good for the whole society because it channels certain energies which, in one direction, which would otherwise go in another direction. And sometimes people go so far as to say we really ought to welcome it because God knows where we would be if it weren't it. That kind of theory depends upon the workings of an internal censor. After all, the whole thing depends upon energies which might go in one way being suppressed and going somewhere else. And that's the Freudian picture that this is all based on. If, however, we have a society in which there's no need for such a censor because the whole thing is legitimated, then the basis of this theory gets to be undermined. And I think the general thought that I would press here is this, that it may be that pornography can have therapeutic value, but only on condition that the censor is kept as the censor. If it tends to encourage the thought, oh, this is perfectly all right, then I think the very theoretical basis upon which the therapeutic thoughts are based is going to be undermined.
You refer to the fact of pornography working to break down the internal and external censors which operate to prevent us doing certain things.
Yes.
How does that work?
Well, the external inhibitor side is that if you want to abuse somebody, you normally have to, at some level, control and influence other people. Pornography can have a role in overcoming other people's controls, and in a sense I could actually show pornography or adult pornography to a group of children, get them to see that sex is good fun and okay, and use that to start to abuse them. And we clearly have had a number of people do that in this country. Pornography also has a way of overcoming the internal inhibitors in people. You actually can show pornography to a boy or girl. You can show them child pornography. You can say, this is okay, this is normal, this is what people do. There's no need at all to be frightened of it. And you actually use it in ways that enable you to carry out the abuse. the problem in child sex abuse and in actual most date and acquaintance rape is that sex abuse is not an incident. It's a relationship. It's a violating and corrupting relationship. Pornography can have a part to play in that violation and corruption, so that when the abuse happens, it's a continuation of that violation. And therefore, the victims don't respond and react and don't come forward and tell, because they feel partly that they are responsible and partly to blame for what's now happening to them.
The essence of pornography is to make sex casual and insignificant. It treats the whole of sex like the modern world treats masturbation. That is to say, it doesn't matter. It's unimportant. It can give you pleasure, of course, and it can contingently bring in its train other sorts of things like friendship and all the rest of it. But in itself, it can be completely casual and inconsequential. The idea that sex has meaning is partly the idea that sex is never casual, even though, of course, it can be entertained casually. But when that happens, even in those cases, it falls under certain kinds of judgments.
So that, in fact, not only sex, but identity, meaning, desire, all those things that we've been speaking of, they would be similarly rendered shallow, perhaps even meaningless, by pornography.
Oh, yes, I think so. And that's a reason for thinking pornography and the kinds of experiences that it caters for and depends upon can't really enter into any serious conception of identity, because the idea of something entering one's identity is the idea of something going deep with one.
Somebody has said to me that, in fact, there's a new generation and that they've lived with pornography and they don't find it so distressing. But I take it that you'd find that symptomatic of our situation.
Oh, yes, it doesn't matter if they find it distressing. I mean, the fact that they don't find it distressing is part of the problem. Just as people who become, as we say, desensitized to brutality, they don't find it distressing anymore. That's part of the problem.
If people are not distressed by it, is it just part of the scenery? It's just there, is it? It's part of the air that we breathe.
Well, I think so. It's, after all, almost omnipresent in one form or another, at least in the form which is meant to suggest that sexuality is intrinsically something inconsequential and that it brings something consequential in its train, but only by addition through something else. That is as it were, the masturbatory thought. It's obvious that being a masturbator can't be a form of identity. And it's interesting to reflect why. But if, as it were, our thoughts about sexuality take masturbation as a kind of guide, if one wants to say, look, just as masturbation is now an unimportant matter and it was wrong to ever think that it was important, so other forms of sexuality are unimportant in themselves but can only become important in this life or that life or whatever, then it seems to me that one has problems in thinking how sexuality can seriously enter a concept of identity.
You mentioned masturbation, and again in the essay you say that the more they masturbate to pornography, the more likely they will be to put their fantasy into practice. What are the connections here?
If a person is having fantasies that are illegal and are masturbating and having orgasm to that thinking, there is more of a chance that one will carry it out in practice. In a sense, many people actually have experience of that outside of what we would call illegal sexuality. In a sense, a person might have a belief system that it's wrong to have an affair. But if they should start to have desire, fantasizing and thinking about a colleague, spending a lot of time thinking about that person, if they start to masturbate and fantasize to having sex with that person, they're much more likely to start behaviors that would actually lead to carrying out the behavior. So I don't think there's a debate that actually fantasy and masturbation to thought can act as a conditioner in some people's thinking and behaviour.
Pornography, you say, feeds the fantasy. But what sort of fantasy are we talking about? Somebody might say, isn't fantasy okay? Isn't it better to fantasise than act out?
Again, I deal with what we call illegal fantasy. I'm very aware that in one sense there's no such thing as an illegal fantasy, but in the work that I do, that's just a working definition to say it is a fantasy that if you put into practice, it's breaking the law. That includes fantasies, therefore, of children sexually and fantasies of rape. Clearly, the men that I work with have actually carried out that behavior, and I'm interested in the fantasies that they have prior to actually abusing children or raping women. In that sense, I think it's right and fair to actually have that debate. And I'm interested in why nearly all the offenders that I've worked with actually had fantasies going beyond what they did in actual practice. I was interested in, even if there was a fantasy or an act of rape, how within their fantasy life they actually went beyond the rape. And I was interested again in the role of pornography within escalation, and that some men clearly did escalate in their offending. One of the problems that I'm faced with within the academic world of debate is that when you're faced with actual clinical experience, it is quite difficult not to accept the role of pornography. For example, recently in England, we were dealing with a military police officer who was 28. He was addicted to pornography. He actually wrote his own sadistic pornography. And in fact, he actually wrote about the rape of a mother and daughter. And then, wearing dark clothing, leather gloves and a balaclava, he took a knife, camera, adhesive tape, and he sneaked into a house occupied by a widow and a 14-year-old daughter. He bound them, he cut the clothing off with knife, he forced fellatio on mother and daughter, he raped the mother, and he buggered the daughter, and he photographed them, both mother and daughter, in various stages of the attack. When we went into his home, we obviously discovered a whole range of pornography, including sadistic. Now, again, you're back to the same argument. I don't believe he went and raped the mother and daughter because of the pornography, but you cannot ignore the fact that within this man's life, there was an escalation of attempting to put fantasy into reality. And at the end of the day, it is women and his children who actually are experiencing and suffering. And this is actually is not just about an academic debate about pornography and its role. I think for those of us who work with sexual crime and who talk to the survivors and to the offenders, I think that what I'm saying has to be listened to. How much credit or value you give it can be part of the debate. But I felt it was still necessary to get into that debate.
You say too at one point that if sex offenders aren't being influenced by pornography, then they have a better chance of changing their behaviour.
Well, that's because pornography has a terrible habit of confirming that distorted thinking and beliefs. They're looking always to justify. So, for example, in a recent pornographic cartoon that was actually being shown to trap children, but let's leave that aside and just look at it as an adult pornographic cartoon, the woman who is raped in the film actually ends up touching herself and saying, well, actually, the rape wasn't that bad. In fact, it was quite nice, is how she actually ends, and the film ends. Now, again, when you're working with rapists who have rape myths about women, that women like a bit of rough, that somehow what they're doing isn't rape, pornography lends itself to actually people believing it. And I think in one study, 97% of rape stories within pornography had the woman changing her mind and having an orgasm. And one of the problems in this debate is that pornography is somehow seen within a vacuum, whereas actually pornography is in a society where there's rejection, where there's betrayal, where there's hurt, where there's conflict, where there's violence, where marriages are breaking up. We're not talking about a nice, sexy, cozy fantasy of masturbation. Maybe a society could cope with it in those terms. But the reality is we are talking about people who are violent, people who abuse, and you cannot therefore ignore the role of pornography in that debate.
So that we're saying in this instance that pornography is a factor. The whole debate you suggested in that article has been bedeviled by the notion of causation. Does it invariably, inevitably, or whatever the word is, lead to killing or sexual violence of one sort or another.
I think that for the debate to be conducted sensibly, one has to admit that you could never show in an individual case that something X had caused Y, that reading a book had led to a certain act. In other words, if you have a very simple cause-effect view, you will always be able to show that it cannot be proven that a particular person has committed crimes because of a particular diet of pornography or violence or whatever. Well, that's getting pretty close, actually. I mean, for example, in the Bulger case in England, the crime that those boys committed against the tiny baby or toddler was mimetic. It imitated something that they'd seen on a film. So you do get cases that are pretty close to cause-effect. But clearly, you know, you have to know a lot more about individuals before you can know why they act. And there's something, in the end, imponderable about all human behaviour. And I wish the whole social science kind of push, which tries to think of us as if, you know, in the way you might think of physics or chemistry, was dropped, and people were able to talk in a kind of more rounded language and see that cause-effect is not the right language to discuss it. The phrase I used in the article, I think, is that it's that pornography, to many sexual criminals and many serial killers, is the kind of culture to which they are drawn. It is the kind of culture to which they naturally feel affinity. It's a kind of an affinitive culture for them. And that's, I think, a much better way of looking at it.
Robert Mann. It's interesting that research sponsored by the pornography makers uses the cause and effect argument again and again. But how do we move the debate on and open it out a bit? Onto the wider culture, which is what Raymond Gaita is more interested in, the kind of stuff which is everywhere around us, at the supermarket, on TV, or in the weekend newspaper.
The Minister for Arts in Western Australia, Ms Hallahan, in particular raised objections about an article titled Hard-Humping Hornback Porks Leso Pig, illustrated with a picture of a half-naked woman and an inflatable pig. Should children be able to purchase a magazine containing that kind of article?
Well, you've told me something I don't know. I've not heard any comment. I think she calls herself Mrs. Hallahan, as a matter of fact, which probably shows more about her than you. I don't know the article. I mean, I don't claim to be. I'm a managing director of a company that's producing 68 different magazines. I don't know the particular article you're talking about. Inevitably, in these magazines, I mean, we have the same criticism, I might say, about our women's magazines. There are a lot of people who say that what we put in Dolly and Cleo and Cosmo aren't suitable for children. But the trouble is, you know, we're not producing these magazines for children.
Wouldn't you then applaud this decision to restrict children getting access to them?
No, because in restricting children, you're actually restricting everybody's access to them. I mean, as I say, by putting them into a very... In fact, the Western Australian situation is that they would be no longer available in newsagents. So that's restricting a lot more than children. It's restricting ordinary people's access to these magazines.
Richard Walsh from Australian Consolidated Press. Once caught up in the matters of censorship and obscenity in the 60s. From the supermarket to the newspapers.
You refer at one point in your article to the Ruth Ostro column in The Australian, where she describes a New York sex parlour, and there are only two restrictions. Safe sex must be practised, and you had to have a partner. She enthused about that place and its possibilities. You disagreed. Why?
Well, she enthused not so much about its possibilities, but what the fact that one could go there might show about the possibilities for us of different sexual identities. There are a number of reasons I disagreed. I thought, first of all, it was interesting that she had no sense, or at least she showed no sense in the article, that the mere fact that she was speaking out of the experience of that kind of parlour might in some ways lessen her authority to do so. No sense at all that she might not be able to trust her thought on moral matters, having come out of such an experience. Plato pointed out long ago that it would seem somehow fundamental to the very nature of vice that it intoxicate one about the idea that there are no limits. It was the essence of vice to suggest that there were no limits. Socrates, in one of the dialogues, drew an analogy between vice and the behaviour of a certain kind of bird, which as it ate, it shat at the same time. And this was, he thought, a marvellous picture of the way in which pleasure was absolutely limitless. So there is, in the very enjoyment of certain kinds of vices, the intoxicating spirit of limitlessness. But there's also the thought that Aristotle was keen to present, which is that if you're inclined to be resistant to doing certain things which at first you think to be the expressions of a vice, the best way to get over that resistance is to keep doing it. And this reminded me once of a letter I saw in a girly magazine, which was roughly like this. I used to think that such and such was wicked, then I tried it and tried it again, and now I like it. The thought expressed in that letter was the very naive thought that if one kept trying out something that one had previously thought to be wicked, if one no longer thought so after a time, that was fine. That showed that it wasn't, in fact, wicked. So there's a kind of naivety just in Ostow's project, which is, as it were, to report reflectively from the experiences, the intoxicating experiences of a sex poem.
There was something of that at a place called the Hellfire Club here, and somebody was watching somebody being beaten, and then described that having been drawn into watching that act, once it had finished, she felt anything was possible.
Yes, that's exactly it. And one of the reasons why one has that experience is because of the limits that there are, the limits which express themselves in our sense that some things are impossible for us to do, morally impossible for us to do, or that some things are wicked. These limits are not like physical limits or the limits of force. Although we are constantly tempted to some kind of analogy to the limits of force, we're constantly tempted to the thought or construing morality as a species of health, and constantly tempted by the thought that if we're wicked, then we'll suffer something like a high cholesterol level or something like a moral heart attack, as though the moral limits really are limits one comes crashing against, in the way in which the limits of certain kinds of physical indulgence are limits that one comes crashing against and one pays for in no uncertain terms. Well, I think moral limits are not like that, and the only ways in which they express themselves are in the old thought that virtue is its own reward and vice is its own punishment.
Just thinking back to Ruth Ostrow in her New York parlour, what about our sexual identities? I mean, have we made them? And are we as free as a bird to recreate our identities?
Well, I think in some sense we have made them. We mean by we here the people of a particular time and a particular culture. I don't think that that implies that we're free to make them as we would wish them. The thought that we might be free to make our identities more or less as we wish them is partly conditioned by a mistaken conception of what follows from the fact that our identities are in some sense cultural creations. From the fact that there is no standpoint outside of all cultures by which we can judge all cultures and to which we ought really to conform, from that fact it just doesn't follow, as far as I can see, that our identities or values are as we have made them, in the sense that implies that there are no serious limits. If you take sexual identity, it seems to me that there are no really interesting entailments from the biological facts of male, being a male or being a female. There are no particular interesting facts to be derived from a morally neutral description of human nature, which somehow forces us or compels us, in the light of, under pain of ignorance, to behave this way rather than that way. But from that, it just doesn't follow that we can now be radically different in our sexual identities, except under pain of shallowness. The fact is, we have made something out of being a male and being a female, and the fact that we can bring children into the world that way. Contingently, we may not have. And it's not necessitated by biology or by truths about human nature that we should have made what we made of this. But as a matter of historical fact, we've made something very deep and profound of it. And that sets limits to what else we can do. and sets limits to the ways in which we might try to rediscover different forms of sexual identity. I don't say that we can't do anything different here, but there can't be limitless playing around with sexual identity except at the cost of shallowness.
Don't dream it.
Don't dream it.
Be it.
Don't dream it.
Be it.
Well, I think the penalty of pornography, so to speak, is to make one shallow. But of course, the recognition that one has become shallow is itself ineluctably from a particular moral perspective. If one's already out of that perspective, tempted out of that perspective by the pornography, if one's thoughts about the matter have already been corrupted by pornography, then the last thing one will see is that one has become shallow. That was part of the point of the quotation from Plato. At a certain point of giving oneself over to vice, the last thing one can see or even comprehend is that that is what one has done. Then in the eyes of such a person, the concept of vice becomes the concept of something that marks a form of old-fashioned fuddy-duddiness or whatever, but nothing to be taken very seriously, something to be mocked, scoffed at, and so on.
Why do you think that wishing for sex without meaning is a corruption? You go on to suggest in that article that you wrote that the case against pornography, in fact, relies on that resistance.
Yes, I think that's so. I think the main thing that is wrong with pornography is that it threatens the meaning of sexuality or the meaning which sexuality has. And this is partly because the meaning of sexuality is for us, or the deepest meaning it has for us at any rate, is connected with the way in which it takes an individual as its object, and irreducibly so. I tried in that article to capture what I meant here by saying that it was in some sense inconceivable to lovers that if one of them failed to satisfy the other sexually, that they could just call in somebody else to finish off the job. And I remarked that I thought the kind of inconceivability that was here in question was not psychological, not just as a matter of fact, we couldn't imagine such a thing, and nor was it straightforward moral inconceivability. It has something to do with our very conception of sexual love. Inconceivable in the same way, for example, that it's inconceivable that you could love someone for only 5 minutes. I mean, there's a conceptual obstacle to someone claiming that. It's not as though we might say, well, let's experiment and let's see if we live long enough to find out that it's possible. You can't. It's just part of the concept of love. And I think it's part of the concept of sexual eros for us that it's in some sense inconceivable that lovers should do this. But there's a dimension of sexuality, however, which is quite the opposite of individualizing and which takes a kind of thing as its object. And I think that debased sex is almost always like this, where there's no obstacle whatsoever to the thought, well, if this one won't do, I'll take that one. Or if this one isn't up to the job, I'll take that one. And I think it's important to see how deep this goes in the very nature of desire.
Raymond Gaita. What Gaita's concerned about, in part, is our estrangement from a way of thinking about sexuality and morality. We need to regain our moral lives, just as once again, 30 years on, we need to regain our sexual lives. Finally, let me introduce Jeffrey Dahmer. I call this program Lost Souls. It was a phrase used by the exotic serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer to describe the 15 men he killed and cut up and skinned, etc., etc., in the 1980s in Milwaukee. He called them lost souls because he fancied they mightn't be missed. I thought of us all as, in some sense, lost souls, where the soul is understood to be the source of human interconnectedness and joy. Dharma lived in isolation, in that very American way, without any supports from anywhere. Isolation was the source of his depravity. When he was at last apprehended, Dharma was building a shrine in his small, deadly apartment. It was to be decorated with the skulls and a few skeletons of his victims.
Dharma is interesting because the way I interpret it, when you put the pornography beside the other things that were preoccupying him, the biblical studies, he was trying to make sense of the world. He was trying to make sense of religion, what is religion telling us, of his own sexuality, of religion and sexuality. And you end up with this bizarre idea of the altar, where he's going to make an altar constructed of the bones and bits and pieces of his victims.
Which he in fact described as a shrine to myself.
Yes. His poor, shrunken, nothing self.
The only place where that small, nothing self could feel at ease was before his shrine. As Dharma said, it was a place where I could feel at home. Reading that, I recalled an old line of the American writer Peter Maron, to make a home for flesh in history. And I remembered Maron saying later that so many Americans live lives on the edge of psychological homelessness. Lost souls. Lost to human interconnectedness and joy. I've always thought that's what pornography is built on. Our anxieties in the face of such loss. Love, the erotic, may transform our loss by joining us to another.
I think sex is fun. I think sexuality and nakedness is an important part of our whole human nature. I just believe that pornography actually isn't the expression of that. Pornography isn't the expression of sexuality in the same way that sex abuse is not an extension of our sexuality. And I think that, for me, is where I would enjoy the continuation of discussion about the difference between pornography and sexuality, erotica, and the sensuality.
In Lost Souls, you heard from Raymond Gaiter, Foundation Professor of Philosophy in the Institute of Advanced Research at the Australian Catholic University, Beatrice Faust, author of Women, Sex and Pornography, published by Penguin in 1986, Robert Mann, editor of Quadrant, and Ray Wire, principal advisor to the Faithful Foundation, which cares for sex offenders and abused women and children. You can read Raymond Gaiter's article on the pornography debate in the April 1994 edition of Quadrant. Pornography, Women, Violence and Civil Liberties, edited by Catherine Itson, is an Oxford paperback. The Shrine of Jeffrey Dharma by Brian Masters is a Coronet paperback. Thanks as ever to Neil Hobbs for technical production. I'm Damien Coleridge. Tapes of the program Lost Souls are available for the usual price, $17, from ABC Radio Tape Sales, GPO Box 9994, Sydney. Or you can ring on 02-333-1034. Next week's encounter is a Margaret Coffey program on health and society ethics. But next on Radio National, following the 8pm news, David Marr presents Arts Today. To take us up to the news, here's some more of Jen Anderson's music for the film Pandora's Box.